This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, Jonathan Meads returns to the show for the eighth time to talk about his new memoir, An Encyclopedia of Myself. Before we start the show, here's a quick message from our sponsors. Little Atoms has teamed up with audible.co.uk to offer you a free audiobook of your choice. All you have to do is register for a 1 month free trial and you can claim your free audiobook. And there are over 80,000 to choose from, including An Encyclopedia of Myself by Jonathan Meads. So why not listen to the show and then go online and register at www.audible.co.uk/little-atoms. And if you use that code, I get a little bit of money. You get your free audiobook. And the 30-day free trial means that even if you decide not to sign up after the 30 days, you get to keep that book. Everybody wins. Jonathan Meads is a writer, journalist, essayist and filmmaker. His books include three works of fiction, Filthy English, Pompey and the Fowler Family Business, and several anthologies, including Museum Without Walls, which was selected as a Book of the Year in 2012 by 9 critics. He has since published a book of photos in postcard form, Pigeon Snaps. His most recent films, Bunkers, Brutalism, Bloody Mindedness, Concrete Poetry, are in praise of architectural aggression and sod-youism. And Jonathan has just published a new book, An Encyclopedia of Myself, which regular listeners to this show will have heard mentioned numerous times on Jonathan's many appearances on this show over the years, but it's finally out. So Jonathan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
So, yeah, we've talked about An Encyclopedia of Myself, I think, going back almost possibly to your first ever appearance on this show. It's been a thing bubbling away in the background. Let's talk about why you've decided to write it.
I think I decided to write it because I wanted to read it, which is
always a good reason for writing.
Though. And it's also a good reason for making films.
Yeah.
But, yes, it was done in the form of an encyclopedia, and I wanted to avoid using a linear narrative because when you digress from the spine, which is the central narrative, you get out onto the end of a vertebrae and then you've got to get back somehow. And this method, the architecture of the book, allows me to achieve something which is closer to a collage than a narrative. And so it's also determined in a way by the fact that one doesn't remember in a joined-up way.
Mm-hmm.
One remembers particular incidents, some of which may seem to a child momentous, others which you have no idea why you remember things because they are not very important. But I have a very capacious memory. But it's also very indiscriminate, as I'm suggesting. And so the actual incident in the book, my only rule was I don't invent anything. I've changed a few names, out of courtesy, really. But I don't invent anything. So what's there is it's an exercise in dredging one's memory and pulling out as much silt as I possibly can. So it goes from things which are seem to be big and affecting to things which are absolutely trivial. And I don't discriminate between them. I mean, if I can remember something trivial, I put it in. And there are lots of stuff I could have put in which isn't there. And it's taken a long time. I mean, one has to have a certain sort of rather bald self-confidence to write about oneself in such a way. I mean, it's not saying it's artless. I'm quite evasive. But it's not a naive book at all, even though it's about naivety when one is quite young.
Because we should say, yes, I mean, it's called An Encyclopedia of Myself. It's autobiographical, but it only covers a very specific period of time.
Yes, I mean, it's about my childhood and early teens. Mm-hmm. And there's actually very little about my early teens. I mean, there's one chapter which is a kind of postscript when I'm 17, but otherwise it really goes up to when I'm about 12, 13.
Mm-hmm. You've described, I was going to bring up the way that the book is written in terms of it being, you know, non-linear. You've described it as in the way that we form thoughts and thoughts are recalled. But also I was thinking it was like, it's quite dreamlike as well in that, you know, you if we're looking at things from the perspective of you as a child, it's interesting how from one chapter it will go, it often takes you a while to work out how old you are and where this is located in time from one chapter to the next.
Yeah, but that again is, I think, to do with the way that one remembers things. I mean, sometimes it's very temporally specific. Mm-hmm. Other occasions it's not, because it's rather... There's a Borges story called Funes the Memorius, which is about a man who suffers an injury, a head injury, mm-hmm. and thereafter he can remember every time he remembers something. So mm-hmm. there's the first memory of, say, a jug of milk on a table. But he then, many, many years later, remembers every time he has remembered that jug of milk mm-hmm. on the table. And one would think that this is about a very specific kind of pathology, mm-hmm. kind of injury, which and so on. But in actual fact, it's kind of a metaphor for the mnemonic process. Mm-hmm. And I do write quite a lot about the processes of memory in the book. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't do it as kind of metafictional way, but I mean, there is quite implicit throughout there is a strain in the book which is does concern itself with how the book is actually made.
Mm-hmm. That's actually interestingly quite the way you just described that Borges story, although it's about a person with a brain injury. I think, and I get this a bit wrong, but that's almost like the state in the art of thinking about memory anyway now, in this idea that you, every time you remember something, you're actually, rather than really pulling something out of a filing system, you're really reconstructing that.
You are, that, yeah. I mean, you remake it all mm-hmm. the time. And mm-hmm. I make that very clear. I mean, the people around who will have known me at that point, and they'll probably have an entirely different take mm-hmm. on things, which be fascinating. I'm actually doing a reading in Salisbury, and I know already that various people who knew me as a child are going to be there.
Anybody mentioned in the book, do you think?
No, I mean, people who are alive, I have most people who are alive, I've changed their names. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the most important people in the book, Ken James, who is the extraordinary polymath, who knew I was writing it, and I had changed it. He died towards the end while I was still writing it, and so I put in his real name. Mm-hmm. I told him previously that I had changed his name, and he seemed perfectly happy with that, because he was a scientist, he was head of the Scientific Civil Service, I mean, and he was he'd signed the Official Secrets Act, mm-hmm. and he said, well, they're not actually going to come and do anything about me now, but it would be better if I was anonymous. And so but then he died, and so I did use his real name. And a lot of people I've used the real name, but some I have changed really out of I don't want to sort of, you know, cause hurt to people who are perfectly innocent.
We'll come back to Ken James and that world a bit later on, because I want to talk at length about that. But something we've mentioned often when we've talked, and specifically in the very last interview that we did, because we were talking about Pompey, the novel, is the connection between your autobiographical memories and how they appear in your fiction and in your films. And again, now having read this book, again, the same places, the same people, the same instances occur, but they're often presented in a very different light. We compared in the last interview Pompey to the film Father to the Man, and how the difference of the presentation of those worlds was. In this book, there's, I guess, much more incident repeated, and obviously the portrayal of your father, again, is very different from that portrayal in that film.
Yes, the film was very specifically about the places where he went to in his capacity as a rep for Crawford's Biscuits, and which was a 40-mile radius around Salisbury. And so he'd take me to places like Winchester, Lymington, Romsey, the outer suburbs of Bournemouth, Wimborne, Sherborne, Shaftesbury, Blandford, etc. And he would say, you know, he'd just let me wander around. I would go in the car with him and he'd say, you know, see you back here at lunchtime. And I'd just wander around these towns. And it was really about, that film was really about an architectural education, which I gave myself without realising that I was giving myself a sort of architectural education, because I didn't know that I was meant to be more in awe of a church than I was of a pub, and so on. And I didn't know anything about the hierarchy of buildings. I learnt very, very early on that to date buildings, at a kind of rather precocious age. But that film was very specifically about this kind of rather unwitting autodidacticism of that period, probably between the ages of about 7 and 12. Whereas this, the Encyclopedia of Myself, is a much broader undertaking, which has very little about architecture in it, actually. It has quite a lot about places, but very, very little about architecture. There's a curious thing, but Salisbury is only just over 20 miles from Southampton, which is where my grandparents and all of my mother's family lived. And 20 miles and kind of chasmically different. Southampton was very badly bombed, and the rebuilding was in two stages. The first stage was extremely undistinguished in the late 1940s, early 1950s, and looks kind of like small-town America. Then, at the end of the 50s, beginning of the 60s, you started getting some very, some great stuff there. Lyons, Israel, Ellis, the town architect, Mr. Berger, L. Berger. There was really good stuff going on. And Salisbury seemed absolutely stuck in a kind of, whenever there was a new building, it was some sort of paltry bit of Neo-Georgian. You know, poor quality. And the only remotely modern building that you got there was a hyperbolic paraboloid roof extension to the Royal Wilton Carpet Factory, done by an architect called Robert Townsend. And that was the only thing. And it seemed absolutely stuck, whereas Southampton seemed to be like kind of the future, you know.
But Southampton then, I guess, was, you know, a port town, and a town that had been heavily bombed and was ripe for that rebuilding, whereas Salisbury is that sort of archetype of that view of England as sort of picture postcard biscuits in box.
It is. But that actually dissembled an awful... that occluded a much more interesting town than it looks, or it was to a child. I mean, I wouldn't, at the age of 17, I couldn't wait to get out and go to London, but I found it very, very fascinating. And I found it fascinating partly because I made myself find it fascinating. I mean, I enjoyed observing the quirks and tics and these rather peculiar people who my parents had much more a gift for acquaintanceship than for friendship. I mean, they were always picking up new people, and I would, you know, just watch them.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Jonathan Meads, and we're talking about his book, An Encyclopedia of Myself. It's often thought of that post-war Attlee National Health Service, Festival of Britain, 1950s Britain, as being some sort of, you know, glorious golden age, Trente Glorieuses, as the same thing in, you know, happened in France. And again, in Fathers of the Man, I think the filter that's on the programme and the music, everything, and the cars and the beautiful, you know, green coffee machines and things. Although you play with that sort of ironically, that puts over that idea as well, I think, a little bit. But it absolutely doesn't in this book. This book does not present a 1950s that anybody in their right mind would want to go back and live in, I don't think.
Right. No, I don't think they would. I mean, I think there's several generalised points. I mean, a lot of my parents' contemporaries and younger contemporaries, I mean, my parents were quite old when I was born. I mean, my father was almost 40, my mother was in her mid-30s. Mm-hmm. And most of my friends had parents who were 10 years younger.
Mm-hmm.
And most of my parents' friends had children who were 10 years older than mm-hmm. I was. So I was in that sort of peculiar position. A lot of people my parents knew seemed embittered by the fact that they had lost 6 years of their youth to the war mm-hmm. and then were living in a state of privation after the war, shortages and mm-hmm. things. Whereas one went, you know, we go to France quite often, which is very unusual for mm-hmm. a kind of lower middle class family, but plus got cheap fares through my grandfather who worked for the ferry company, which Southern Railways were trying to think. So, and France seemed to be incredibly modern. I mean, mm-hmm. they had formica and plastic and extraordinary looking cars, you know, whereas England post-war looked pre-war.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right up to the time when the Mini came in 1959,
mm-hmm.
I just think a third of the cars that one saw were pre-war cars, mm-hmm. or cars which looked pre-war because, you know, they didn't tool up to start making modern-looking stuff till the early 50s. I mean, there were lots of things manufactured after the war which were exactly the same model that had been mm-hmm. made pre-war. And this, but to go back to this thing of the embitteredness of many people at that time, it created an ethos in which there was no kind of, you know, child-friendly upbringing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had to just brace up and do what your parents were doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do remember a single place which was known as a child-friendly hotel, which was at Studland near Poole Harbour,
mm-hmm.
Which was called Knoll House. And basically there was a sandpit and some climbing frames where kids could play while their parents got kind of legless inside at the bar. And that's as far as it went, because mm-hmm. My parents weren't interested in doing kiddie things at mm-hmm. all. I was once taken to the model village at Boughton-on-the-Water in the Cotswolds, but otherwise I just did what they wanted. And
dragged you along.
Well, what they wanted was my father fished fanatically all the time. And I don't really know what my mother... I mean, she used to, you know, play bridge a lot and so on. And I actually did play bridge quite a lot too in my teens. And I would also make the point, which I don't know if I'm particularly specific about it in the book, that in those days people didn't drink, wine was not much drunk. People mm-hmm. drank beer and spirits. And there were a lot of people who were sort of very, I mean, I don't think spirits in general are a particularly good idea, you know. I mean, they make people angry and mm-hmm. so on. And this seemed to, there are a lot of people who were very, very angry, very permanently irate, and thought of children as a ruddy nuisance.
You just mentioned this idea that your parents were always making friends, but at the same time, you often described them in the book as quite insular and a very sort of tight-knit coupling. You felt yourself as someone who was intruding when you came along, intruding on their marriage, and it possibly comes from this interesting relationship that they have with other members of your father's family, which you talk about in the book in quite detail. So can we talk for a bit about that, the sort of family structure that you were observing?
The family structure was this. My mother couldn't stand my father's family, and my father couldn't stand my mother's family. It's simple as that. I much preferred my mother's family. My father was one of four siblings, and he was the only one who had led a life which could be remotely described as normal. The eldest of them was, I think, a literally maiden aunt. I describe her as the virgin witch, which is kind of quite a nice thing. So she was the most unpleasant woman. She was a miser. She was extremely misanthropic. I mean, really, really quite unpleasant person. She lived with her mother all her life
mm-hmm.
and kept on talking about the sacrifice she'd made, but in actual fact, she was just incredibly idle. My mother really loathed her.
Mm-hmm.
Then he had an elder brother who, as I say, led a life which seemed to come out of Larkin, although we know that Larkin didn't really lead that sort of life in retrospect. But he went to Birmingham University, took a degree in law, qualified as a solicitor whilst working it for Birmingham Town Clerk's Department, became Deputy Town Clerk of Burton-on-Trent, and then at last achieved the big one. He became Town Clerk of Burton-on-Trent, not Deputy, but the Town Clerk, in which capacity he pulled down all of the maltings, allowed them to pull them down, which was a dreadful act of vandalism. I mean, the maltings in Burton were rather wonderful, and they destroyed the narrow gauge railway, which went through the streets of Burton from sort of maltings to Cooperage and so on.
I'm Natalie Haynes, you're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
You've talked about that in your television films in the past. Well, I didn't realise till I read this book how close that, how personal that connection was.
Yes, yeah. And anyway, and he went. He never married. He lived in Diggs. There was a big event in 1949 when the people he lived in Diggs with moved to another house in Burton, and he moved with them. He went home to Evesham, where my grandmother and his virgin sister lived, every weekend. It's a very, very strange life. And then there was the younger brother, Reg, who was known as Wangle, who was kind of... he was, there's something fanatical about him. He would swim every day of the year. When I was small, he lived in a flat in Southbourne, which is the eastern, one of them, then the easternmost boundary of Bournemouth, but Bournemouth now is kind of sprawl, which goes on about 25 miles along the coast. And he used to just pop across the road and swim. Then he thought he wanted to be closer to nature, so he bought a caravan and parked it on the shore at Highcliffe so that the waves actually broke over the caravan, and he was moved on. There's a photograph of me with his caravan where he has, after he's moved to a proper caravan park with an El San toilet, and he had a very frail valetudinarian wife called Anne, who had open heart surgery when open heart surgery was in its infancy, and he took her to recuperate by going. They went camping in Scotland, as one does, and she died. So they're pretty crazy people. They all had the one who became town clerk, Hank and Wangle, were kind of rather blood and soil. They kind of had this sort of thing about, you know, striding across Breeden Hill and the Morvans and so on, and they were sort of, they felt they were linked to this particular patrimonial sod. And as I say, I think this is absolute balls and roots are for vegetables, you know. But that was their, you know, their life, and I used to get sort of holidays. I always used to have to go and stay with Wangle and Anne, and you know, he'd berate me if I put on a pullover because it's a sissy thing to do and things like this, you know. I mean, it's... but my mother's family, on the other hand, I thought were great. I mean, they were very kind of... they had no aspirations to any kind of culture. I mean, Hank and Wangle were great readers of people like Henry Williamson, H.J. Massingham, outdoorsy stuff about Britain and our lynx and our Celtic thing, and all kind of borderline racist sort of stuff. In fact, not borderline by today's standards. I mean, certainly kind of fairly racist. My mother's family were... It's important to realise that both Benny Hill and Ken Russell came from the same part of Southampton as my parents. My mother knew both families. And I always think of Benny Hill and Ken Russell as twins who are separated at birth. I mean, they look very similar, kind of lardy looking, very similar sort of Donald McGill postcard kind of sense of humour, bawdy, vulgar, and with a kind of vitality. And this is what my great aunt Dole, for instance, who say, she loved a ship's captain. She wasn't that fussy about rank, though. I mean, she liked some of the other people on the ship as well. And Dorothea Hogg, she's great. And she's the first woman in Southampton to have her own car and lived to a very, very great age. I mean, almost made 100. And she'd always be saying things like, just to the brim, would you, if you don't mind? I'd like to see a Harry meniscus on mine. It's just wonderful. And they were all like that. And, you know, my Uncle Eric, who, my mother's sister's husband, he only read two things: Glass's Guide to Secondhand Car Prices and Giles Annuals. And that was it. No other books in the house. He liked the sports page of the Southern Evening Echo. He was Southampton supporter, as I am. And, you know, I used to love going down to the Dell with him. So he knew everyone. I mean, you know, so they're all. But it was great. There was none of the kind of bogusness and piety of my father's family at all. And I knew them much better because it was 35 minutes on the train. We just used to go down there on Saturday. My mother much preferred shopping in Southampton to shopping in Salisbury because, I mean, you know, it's much bigger. Mm-hmm. It's 10 times the population, so it's got, you know, much better shops and so on. And they used to what particular word they used to use of the predominantly Malaysian and Filipino sailors, who they used to call Lascars. That pub is all full of Lascars.
Sherlock.
What? Yes. But, you know, these are all people. I mean, my great-aunt Doll would have been... My mother was born in 1912. My great-aunt Doll would have been born 1890, something like that. And there are other ones, too. I mean, other relations, but, you know, apart from Doll, I mean, my grandparents, there were... there's Mary's sister. There were a load of cousins and so on, including the one who managed to fail to consummate his first two marriages. they had a much greater influence on me than my father's family, who were all desperately trying to be kind of respectable and outdoorsy and a lot of striding going on, you know.
But in some respects, well, apart from the Benny Hill aspect, in some respects, your father's family seem to have had more of an influence over your work in terms of, when I think of the films, I mean, often they'll be in opposition to those things, but you'll do films about, you know, the Garden City movement and a lot of the outdoor stuff. I mean, there was the one about Worcestershire, which featured, you know...
That is very much like a trial run for parts of the book, yeah.
Sure, but this idea that theme of the sort of the ridiculousness of the whole blood and soil thing, I think, crops up time and time again in your work.
Ridiculousness of
the whole blood and soil thing.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think it was a very important thing in Britain in that generation, and I think they were particularly caricatural exemplars of it. Mm-hmm. But there was a lot of it about.
Listening to Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Jonathan Meads, and we're talking about his book, An Encyclopedia of Myself. And Jonathan, you've already alluded to this in the first part of the show, but I want to look at the Cold War industry in Salisbury as you were growing up. You've spoken a few times in the past about the fact that Salisbury, as you were growing up, was the two industries were God and the Cold War. And God, I think we've covered off more than enough times in the past. So let's look at the idea of how the Cold War affected the city in some detail, if we can.
Well, Salisbury, with the exception of the area around Aldershot and Camberley, Salisbury has the kind of greatest concentration of military in Britain. The southern part of Salisbury Plain is littered with army camps. Nook, Fuggleston, which is the headquarters of Southern Command, Lark Hill, which is artillery, Bulford, Tidworth. And as well as military, there's aeronautical testing station at Boscombe Down, which is where the V-bombers were developed, and Porton Down, microbiological warfare. And Salisbury doesn't have any university. There's no place of tertiary education. So the sort of intellectual life of the city was mostly led by these scientists, mm-hmm. who quite secretive stuff going on at Porton. And I was particularly friendly with a man called Ken James, who was deputy head of Porton. And when he was about to become head of it, he was picked by someone in Wilson's government to become a kind of advisor to the cabinet, mm-hmm. and so on, especially Dennis Healy, who he had a lot of time for. Had a great deal of time for Wilson as well. Couldn't stand Tony Benn, thought he was stupid.
And Edward Heath, who ended up being a neighbour.
Well, Edward Heath did end up being a neighbour, but, I mean, Kent would just laugh when Heath's name was mentioned. I think that's an unusual reaction in Salisbury, because most people couldn't stand him. His sort of pomposity and weird. As I say, he wasn't ill-mannered, he just didn't seem to know about manners at all. It's kind of something which had passed him by. But the Porton Down was very interesting. There were people taking LSD there 6 years before Aldous Huxley did. And Ken hugely regretted the way in which, because Huxley had this bent towards sort of transcendence and so on, it kind of coloured the way in which LSD was used recreationally, and it got sort of hijacked by, you know, camper van mystics and so on. Whereas Cairn and various other people who took it didn't think of it in that way. They thought of it as possibly a psychiatric tool, and also as a kind of aesthetic trigger. But I mean, they were, you know, Ken was particularly anti religion, and said things like, you know, my generation, it was only the rather stupid, and of course the Irish, who went in for that stuff. And I went on seeing him right up to the end of his life, and well, he died at the age of 94, was it? Something like that. And he said that the thing that most surprised him was the reawakening of religion. He said he expected, he could never have foreseen that was going to happen. He said, you know, a lot of other things have panned out as one would have predicted, but that particularly was a kind of phenomenon which no one could have foreseen.
Well, that happened obviously on a wider level as well, but, you know, more locally, I guess. I would imagine then he had something of an antipathy towards Tony Blair.
I think he probably... I doubt if his antipathy to Tony Blair was as strong as my antipathy to Tony Blair. But, yes, I mean, I think he thought he was... He thought of him as being frivolous. He, you know, compared with Wilson, whom he thought was a serious man. And, indeed, that entire cabinet, you know, Crossland, Crossman, Jenkins, etc. I mean, they were very clever people. I mean, far more considerable people than one gets in politics now, I think. But the importance of Porton was that the people there also, these were earnest people, and trying to second guess how to conduct a war against the possibility of the Soviets. And one forgets how imminent how close we were always to kind of Armageddon. You know? There were a lot of saber rattling and so on. And we really was tangibly the other industry of that town because of the sheer presence of the military. Everyone, you know, we knew people who worked at Boscombe Down. I had a godfather, an atheist, who used to. Who was a boffin who would wear a thing like a space suit and go up in V-bombers all the time. I mean, and they were two major employers. And, of course, you know, they got in the news occasionally when there were tests which went wrong, but there were very few tests which went wrong. And things when Geoffrey Bacon, who through rather lax standards contracted bubonic plague and died... But and I remember Ken saying that he was astonished there weren't more accidents because people weren't particularly, everyone's a bit gung ho. They weren't particularly attentive to the regulations about safety, and they're dealing with kind of extremely toxic poisons and
stuff. The Tesson soldiers of sarin gas and things. And I mean, I was going to say, you mentioned this idea of sort of all pervasive atmosphere of Armageddon that hung over the place, which we tend to forget nowadays. But nowadays, we would, you know, Porton Down is a name of horror, of the idea, you know, chemical warfare.
Yeah, I suppose I was brought up to think that this is a necessary evil.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think. I still think of it thus. I mean, I think in the age of apology, you know, everyone's saying sorry, sorry, sorry about this, and sort of new inquests being held to, you know, turn around death by misadventure into something which is makes people more culpable. But I don't think they thought they didn't think what they were doing was wrong. I mean, they weren't behaving like the camp doctors. They weren't Mengele. I mean, they were scientists trying to defend the country, and you know the I suppose the military were the same in a way, but of course it was kind of a different thing because there's still national service, and anyone born before October 1939 had to do national service. I mean, you get deferred and so on. But there was a very different kind of military around. I mean, there were a lot of people who didn't want to be in the military. Mm-hmm. So it was much more. There was a lot of low level violence. Mm-hmm. You know, these people letting off steam and
well,
so
this
on.
Happens, yeah, in all of those sort of Aldershot and Reading and all of those other towns.
Yeah, yes.
Associated with the military. Well, Colchester, I guess, as well. Yeah. The local one.
But Colchester doesn't have the sheer numbers that Salisbury area had. And, of course, the camps there are out in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would all pour in at the weekends, often in uniform, which they don't do now.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite sort of gamey.
That era as well, the sort of post-war era, was a time of, because everybody had been away and fought at the war, and a lot of the sort of social class divisions that had existed before the war were, for a period of time at least, seemed to be lessening. There was sort of an end of a sort of era of deference that we'd had before as well. But the other thing that you talk about quite a lot in the book is this idea of people after the war, a certain amount of ranks in the armed services were allowed to retain their rank after the war, and people would still identify them by that. And there was this, you basically refer to them as bogus majors.
No, a lot of them weren't bogus majors. A lot of them were majors. There were a number of bogus majors, but I mean, a lot weren't, and people did hang on to their rank. I think that was tied up with what you just mentioned, the kind of deference.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this was a way of obtaining kind of deference. And I think that went on for a long time after the war. I think that went on well into the 60s, that sort of, you know, the gradations of class were still apparent and still quite sharply delineated, I think, way into the 60s. Okay, mm-hmm. The 60s... really, you know, the 60s didn't happen until the 70s for most people. The 60s, as in the kind of stereotypical cliche, happened to David Bailey and 1,000 of his closest friends. Mm-hmm. You certainly didn't see much evidence of in Salisbury. I mean, obviously, they're kids with long hair and short skirts, and there was some low rent coffee bars and so on. But for the most part, this was only a kind of youth thing. I mean, the big changes in the 60s were affected by Roy Jenkins rather than by the Rolling Stones, you know. Thank you.
I'm J. Courtney Sullivan. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Well, you mentioned a couple of stories about, I mentioned the idea of the bogus majors. You said not all of them were, but certainly some of them were. There's an interesting story that you tell about an encounter that you had with your father in a pub in the, it was in the Lake District.
Yes. Well, my father, it's not quite the Lake, it's just on the edge of the Lake District, actually. We went into this pub, and it's odd, my father sort of, I could tell that there was a slight tension, which I'd never actually witnessed in him before. I mean, and he started talking to the guy behind the bar, and he recognised him as a guy who had absconded with a considerable amount of money from Pi Force, which was the Persia and Iraq force, which my father was a member of. He was part of it from 1942 to 1946. And this guy had made up fictional employees, fictional contractors, I think, and got money from them, and he sifted it away. And he'd evidently come back to England with an Indian wife and bought this pub in the middle of nowhere and had changed his name. And my father didn't know what to do about it, and it rankled with him for years after. You know, he talked to various friends who he'd had in the army. I mean, there was one chap who lived nearby who was a not very successful actor, and he talked to various people, you know, what do we do about it? And they said, well, look, just don't bother about it. You're going to have a hell of a job trying to prove this. No one's going to be interested in a white-collar crime which happened 12 years previously.
And indeed, who would you report it to?
Well, who? Yes. Yeah. I mean, because it was in, you know, this happened in Basra. So it really weighed on him. This very curious man who I've actually changed his name because he had a child, and I thought it would be, and I haven't identified exactly where it was in the Lake District. I mean, well, sort of, you know, Lakeland, Greater Lakeland, rather than sort of, you know, Ullswater or one of those bits. But the bloke, of course, denied it. That he was this, and just so you know, you make a mistake. And of course, it's possible he was making a mistake, but I think probably not, because he didn't identify him immediately by what he looked like, but by his kind of curious vocal tics.
There's a lot of the lakes and, you know, that area, Cumbria or Westmoreland or whatever. I guess it was at that point in the book, which quite surprised me, because that's not really an area you've covered in your work. Do you have any sort of plans to do a film about that?
No, I haven't got any plans to do it. It's where I was conceived, in a kind of boffy which belonged to a friend of my mother's, who fellow teacher, and her husband, who was a submariner during the war. He was head of classics at Westminster School, and apparently everyone I ever met who was taught by him said that he didn't really teach classics, he just talked about submarines all the time. And my parents borrowed their bothy after the war, and that's where I was conceived. And we used to go on holiday there to this very go on holiday to this wonderful place called the Newfield Inn in the Duddon Valley, which is actually in Lancashire. It's Furness was part of Lancashire then. And I absolutely loved it, I adored it. It's one of my sort of favourite places in the world, the Duddon Valley. It's a strange valley because it's very difficult to get. At one end you've got Hardknott Pass and Rhino's Pass, and at the other end you've got the fells coming up from Broughton and Furness. And in the war, my mother used to take them 3.5 days to get there from Salisbury. But they lived off the fat of the land, literally, because people had chickens, sheep, etc. And the milk marketing board and things couldn't get in. Lorries could not get into this valley. It's just so, and there's no. It's still very untouristic. There are lots more people. Last time I went there a few years ago, there are a lot more walkers wearing kind of fluorescent walking things. But there are no more cars than there were in the 50s. I mean, it's just like off the map, and it's absolutely great. But one of the reasons we went there was because it was the great fishing. My father's topographies were entirely determined by fishing. You know, they even moved house. He wouldn't move house till he could find somewhere a place beside the river. You know, and it gave me a love of rivers. Not in the least bit interested in fishing at all. I find it incredibly boring. But you know, rivers like the Duddon, which is all waterfalls and beautiful waterfalls, and the rivers in Salisbury too. I mean, there are five rivers joined up in Salisbury, and they're, you know, water meadows, which I filmed in. Father to the Man, which I don't really write much, as I say, I don't write much about in this book. About, I mean, I'm much more interested in, you know, people in this book, and you know, so there's a bit about places, but not in you know, for people who know my television work. I mean, they would probably feel either shortchanged or surprised that there isn't that emphasis.
I want to finish off the interview just having a quick look at the brutalism films, now they've been aired since the last time we spoke about them. But just to finish off on the book, as you mentioned, apart from a brief sort of postscript where you're 17, this is all about your childhood and
it's basically prepubescent. I mean, it's up to, you know, up to 13,
So couldn't we expect to see another volume once, because there's obviously nothing in here about RADA and about telly and right, and you know, the early years in journalism. Is that a later volume?
No. I think if I was to write a sequel, it would be in an entirely different form, and I'd write something like Brief Lives about dead friends, most of whom no one's going to have heard of. I mean, one person who was briefly unbelievably famous. But it's also about failure to an extent. I mean, these people who messed up their lives one way or another. I mean, you know, sort of people drinking themselves to death in seaside towns. people who are kind of rather careless, but I would write that as kind of perhaps 10 or 12. I mean, I made a list of people, my exact contemporaries who've died, 40 of them. Which is extraordinary, because we thought we were going to live longer than our parents, but I don't think that's working out that way. But of those 40 people, I think 15 or so, it might pan out. I mean, it's just something I've been thinking about recently. I haven't got any great plans about it, but you know, there come some interesting lives there. And quite rackety. I don't mean, criminal, but sort of borderline. I mean, one of these guys is mentioned in there, actually, in the thing under Bogus Majors. The Bogus Major thing came about because a friend of mine used this guy as a driver, and who once said to me, "Do you like those post-war films, black and white? You know, sort of Eric Portman, Nigel Patrick, John Mills, they're jolly good, aren't they? You know, I wish I'd been born there. I could have been a Bogus Major." And he's saying this absolutely seriously. And he was a friend of this guy, this sort of, who I describe as a tearaway, who was once looking after Tessa Wyatt's Budgerigar and decided to shoot it. And he got an air gun and he started shooting at the cage. And he managed to miss the bird, just rather damaged the cage. And that's fairly typical of this guy's behaviour. I mean, he died of drink and drugs in Weymouth.
It's the only way to go in Weymouth.
I rather like Weymouth,
Irving Finkel, and you're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So just to finish off then, I just want to have a brief look at Bunker's Brutalism, Bloody-Mindedness, Concrete Poetry, which is the long and correct name for your recent two shows on brutalism. The first one particularly, it seemed to me it was like as well as being a look at the history and how brutalism came about, it seemed to be, you know, quite a summation of a lot of the preoccupations of your career to date, not least because it used a lot of footage from your old films. I think I counted at least 5 or possibly 6 shows that were used in it. And this is not something that you've done before. Why? What was that about?
It's to do with the fact that BBC won't fund the things properly.
Mm-hmm. So it was budgetary reasons. So we were,
but I quite liked it. I mean, it was. I mean, most of my.
I thought it worked really well.
Most of my telly, and this book, it does have an element, quite a strong element of collage in it, mm-hmm. and generally, I haven't made the armature of the films quite as explicit as in the Brutalism film. I mean, it's more obviously mm-hmm. the collage than previous stuff, which is is certainly collage, but it's to an extent it doesn't proclaim itself thus. Mm-hmm. Whereas that this one, the method is made absolutely transparent. I mean, mm-hmm. it made absolutely clear. And we could have, I suppose, have instead of using a studio for about a third of the shoot or half the shoot, we could have gone to other places. But it's, I think I like working in studios. Frank likes working in studios. Frank Hanley, who directs most of my stuff, and you can invent more mm-hmm. in such circumstances. Obviously, there were certain places which we very definitely wanted. We filmed a lot in Skopje mm-hmm. and Vienna, Dusseldorf, etc. One of the problems with doing 120 minutes of stuff on generically kindred buildings is that we could have gone off to say quite a lot of stuff I'm interested in Switzerland. But doing it in the studio does breaks it up more. Yeah. It lends the thing kind of greater variety than it would have if it was just done all on location. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the next thing I intend to do, I mean, if they'll go along with it, will be done on location, is having done Joe Building mm-hmm. and Jerry Building, about respectively about Soviet architecture and Nazi architecture. I want to do one called Ben Building about our friend the swinging Mussolini,
who, as we've talked about before, actually had some taste.
Yes, he did have taste, and there's a huge variety of work done in during his time, and some of it really quite astonishing. I mean, kind of very late 30s. Neo-Baroque. Mm-hmm. I mean, really extremely sort of over-the-top stuff. And obviously the Terragni and kind of Italian rectilinear modernism. There's also kind of hangover from Art Nouveau, mm-hmm. Gino Coppedè, who is actually mentioned in the Brutalist film. Mm-hmm. Two other kinds of modernism. So Art Deco in the colonies in Tripoli mm-hmm. and Asmara and so mm-hmm. on, and also this very curious stuff which, if you just looked at it, you'd think it's probably Swedish or Scandinavian mm-hmm. looking stuff, the style which they used in the new towns on the marshes mm-hmm. south of Rome, where they drained the marshes, and Latina and Sabaudia mm-hmm. and so on, which looked like, there's obviously an influence of De Chirico and those, kind of lonely townscapes, sort mm-hmm. of where there's no human, looks like no human's ever been there or ever mm-hmm. will go there. And cross between that and the sort of Scandinavian modernism, and which the British Library kind of seems to come in there somewhere, mm-hmm. in that sort of mm-hmm. Strange building, the British Library.
In the second of the two Brutalism films, as well as describing, you feature a number of people, Owen Hathley, for instance, people who are like write books and blogs about Brutalism or take photographs or paint art about it. But also, at the same time, you show a number of buildings, newer buildings. So there's almost something of a revival in architectural terms as
well. Yeah, I think there is, but not in Britain. Mm-hmm. Or there's quite a lot in Germany, mm-hmm. in Austria, in Georgia, Why this should be, I don't know. But I haven't. There seems to be very little. There are no signs of any kind of revival of it here, which I given the abysmal standard of stuff that's been put up in London, I mean, it's rather a pity. And London's really become sort of a kind of inventory of architectural bling. I mean, there's some shocking stuff around.
That's a perfect point for us to end, I think. So I've been talking to Jonathan Meads, and we've been talking about his book, An Encyclopedia of Myself, which is out. Is it out now?
When did
it come out? It is out now.
Yeah.
From Fourth Estate. So, Jonathan, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me again.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.